Hey there, it's Shamitha. I've got a quick request for you. If Apple News Today is an essential part of your morning routine, follow the show in Apple Podcasts. And if you have another 30 seconds, leave us a rating and a review too. It helps other people find our show and it helps us know what you like about it. Thanks. Good morning. It's Thursday, November 6th. I'm Shamitha Basu. This is Apple News Today. On today's show, the latest escalation in Sudan's civil war, how delivery apps transformed American dining, and Representative Nancy Pelosi plans to retire after nearly 40 years in Congress. But first, to the shutdown, officially the longest ever. Yesterday, we had another unprecedented announcement. The Trump administration has ordered a 10% flight reduction in 40 of the country's major airports, which Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy said would bring additional disruptions.
We have seen staffing pressures throughout our airspace. Those who travel will see that we've had more delays. We've had more cancellations. We do not want to see disruptions at the FAA or here at DOT. We don't want that. But our number one priority is to make sure when you travel safely.
Duffy said high volume pressure points would be targeted and the locations would be announced today, with reductions starting Friday. He's previously warned of mass chaos for travelers if the shutdown continued. Remember, the country is already 2,000 people short of the air traffic controllers it needs. FAA Administrator Brian Bedford suggested that the issues, if left unchecked, would prevent him from being able to declare the U.S. airline system the safest in the world.
I'm not aware in my 35-year history in the aviation market where we've had a situation where we're taking these kind of measures. I think it is unusual, just as the shutdown is unusual, just on the fact that our controllers haven't been paid for a month is unusual. These are unusual times, and we look forward to a time when we can get back to business as usual.
Until then, the shutdown is continuing to put pressure on people's lives in big and small ways. And Trump has begun to show his frustration to lawmakers, particularly after the GOP election defeats on Tuesday. Yesterday, he gathered a group of Republican senators for a breakfast. There, he delivered his own verdict on what went wrong for the party.
I think if you read the pollsters, the shutdown was a big factor, negative for the Republicans. And that was a big factor. And they say that I wasn't on the ballot was the biggest factor. But I don't know about that, but I was honored that they said that.
After the cameras left, Axios reports that it became an uncomfortable meeting, as Trump warned lawmakers they would be seen as do-nothing Republicans if the shutdown continued. And he again called for Republicans to pursue what's long been seen as a radical option: eliminate the filibuster, that is, changing the Senate rules requiring 60 votes for most legislation. But this call has inspired rare dissent from GOP leadership. Both Senate Majority Leader John Thune and House Speaker Mike Johnson have dismissed the idea, either because the votes aren't there or because they fear what it would mean if Democrats won majorities. In his assessment of this week's election results, Johnson avoided joining Trump in pinning the blame on the congressional standoff.
What happened last night was blue states and blue cities voted blue. We all saw that coming. And no one should read too much into last night's election results. Off-year elections are not indicative of what's to come. That's what history teaches us.
Meanwhile, talks on how to get the government moving again are stepping up, according to Politico. They're centered on whether to at least agree on a short-term measure called a continuing resolution, and for how long, and whether Democrats could agree to a guaranteed vote on expanding health care subsidies. Senator Bernie Sanders outlined the steps he would need to see.
If we had a commitment from the Speaker of the House that he was prepared to support a strong extension of ACA credits, and if the President of the United States, and I don't trust him, so he's going to have to figure out how he structured this, was saying that he was prepared to sign it, I think we should end the shutdown tomorrow. If you had that commitment. But if you simply had a nebulous vote that wasn't going to go anyplace, I think we got to continue the fight.
Axios reports that for some Democrats, that positioning has only strengthened following the election. Let's turn to an underreported part of the world. The ongoing civil war in Sudan has been escalating in recent weeks, and it's now being called the worst humanitarian crisis on Earth. And a warning, this story has some graphic descriptions of war and violence. Mass executions and sexual violence have been reported, and this week a famine was formally declared. The world has condemned the killings, but this is a complicated conflict with no clear route to peace. We spoke to Alex Duvall, the executive director of the World Peace Foundation at the Fletcher School at Tufts University and an Africa analyst for the BBC.
So this is a war between two generals who are really fighting over who gets to be the ruler of Sudan.
Duvall told us at its core, this conflict centers on two factions who ruled the country together after ousting the president back in 2019. But that alliance soon broke down and descended into a power struggle between the Sudanese armed forces and a militia group called the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. Since 2023, over 150,000 people are thought to have been killed and millions displaced. And now the war appears to be heading for a violent turning point. Last week, the militias seized El-Fasha, the Sudanese armed forces' last stronghold in Darfur.
The people of El-Fasha feared that they would be literally put to the sword, chopped to death, if El-Fasha were overrun. And that is what we are seeing happening today.
The United Nations believes that 200,000 civilians were stuck in El-Fasha at the time it was overrun by the RSF. And shocking reports note that the devastation can quite literally be seen from space.
We also have satellites that can actually track the numbers of bodies. You see them from satellite photographs, like autumn leaves strewn across the streets and squares and fields of El-Fasha. And we have the reports of local humanitarian workers who tell us the stories of the survivors of these massacres and whose children come in, every single one of them malnourished and starving because hunger is being used as a weapon in this war as well as massacre.
Thousands of people have tried to flee El-Fasha, including Ikrem Abdel Ahmed, who shared her story with a local journalist via an interpreter on PBS NewsHour. Her daughter and son-in-law were killed, and she's now raising her infant grandson with little to no food.
We came running. They were chasing us, firing rockets over our heads. They took the men out and lined them up, and they shot them in front of us. They lined them up and shot them in the street and left them.
This is not the first time Darfur has witnessed large-scale suffering. 20 years ago, massacres in the Darfur region provoked international horror and captured the attention of Western leaders. At the time, President Bush became the first UN Security Council member to declare it a genocide and gave billions of dollars in humanitarian aid, while A-list celebrities like George Clooney took on UN roles to raise awareness. The capture of El-Fasha and the possibility of the RSF controlling an entire vast region of Sudan has added urgency to conversations about an end to the atrocities. In recent days, the RSF agreed to a U.S. proposal for a ceasefire, but the Sudanese armed forces rejected the proposal and vowed to fight on. The Trump administration said yesterday they would continue their efforts with the region's stakeholders. Is ordering in, eating away at the traditional idea of the restaurant? That's the question asked in a recent piece in The Atlantic. It wasn't so long ago that there was a clear culinary divide between what's traditionally considered a takeout food, like pizza, and everything else. But last year, nearly 3 out of every 4 restaurant orders in the U.S. weren't eaten in a restaurant. The food delivery industry that didn't really exist 15 years ago brings in tens of billions of dollars each year. And as the U.S. has transformed into a nation of order-inners, restaurants are struggling to keep up. Atlantic staff writer Ellen Cushing told us what this has meant for establishments.
The change that is happening right now is that these full-service restaurants that previously used to be full of people on a Friday night celebrating a birthday or a graduation or something, those are the restaurants that are now being really taken over by deliveries.
In other words, as Cushing puts it in her piece, more and more new restaurants opening in big cities aren't geared toward in-person dining at all, but are basically dinner factories built for deliveries. The shift in restaurants operating more like pickup counters was supercharged by tech companies like DoorDash and Postmates in the early 2010s. Apps like Grubhub and Seamless stepped in to be the intermediary between customers and restaurants who weren't really sure how to build their own websites and payment portals. These companies subsidized the cost of delivery to attract new customers and get them hooked on takeout. Customers got cheap delivery, restaurants made money, and Silicon Valley covered the difference.
That was a huge, huge change. And that kicked off an era where individual restaurants are no longer in charge of delivery. They're handing over a major part of their operation to other companies. And that kicked off the era that we are in now, where delivery is kind of eating the American restaurant.
The COVID pandemic entrenched the idea that restaurant food at home was no longer just an occasional indulgence for those who could afford it. Restaurants who hadn't started offering delivery yet began to in order to survive. And because the people making these deliveries are generally paid by the delivery and not by the hour, Cushing points out that delivery workers now have one of the most dangerous jobs in the country, often feeling pressure to make as many deliveries as possible, even in periods of heavy traffic or hazardous weather conditions.
Delivery unleashed hundreds of thousands of vehicles onto American streets and then gave the people driving them or riding them, in the case of e-bikes, like a huge incentive to move really fast.
Eventually, delivery companies consolidated with DoorDash and Uber, which together now control about 90% of the U.S. market for delivery. The subsidies went away, and those costs were passed on to consumers and restaurants. We've reached a point where, as Cushing points out, customers are getting charged more, drivers are making less, and restaurants are mostly losing out. One restaurant group owner told Cushing last year her restaurants made half their sales on delivery. Of that, 23% went to delivery companies. She said, quote, "Delivery saved us during the pandemic. Now they are killing us." Before we let you go, a few other stories we're following. The Supreme Court expressed skepticism over the legality of President Trump's tariffs during oral arguments Wednesday. Several of the court's conservative members, along with the liberal wing, appeared doubtful the president had the authority to impose wide-ranging tariffs on goods from nearly every country the U.S. does business with. Justice Neil Gorsuch noted that Congress has the power to levy taxes and regulate foreign commerce. And he seemed wary of expanding the president's power, asking what would prevent lawmakers from simply handing other powers, like declaring war, to the president. The court's decision could have major implications on global trade and the economy. It's also the first big test as to whether the court will expand or limit Trump's assertion of power in his second term. A judge criticized Justice Department prosecutors for their highly unusual handling of James Comey's case, which a judge said had a feeling of indict now, investigate second. At a hearing yesterday, a judge pressed for direct answers on what evidence the prosecutors had and ordered them to present their materials. Comey is charged with lying to Congress in a case President Trump urged the DOJ to pursue. He's pleaded not guilty and says it's a vindictive prosecution. And some news from Washington. Nancy Pelosi, the first female Speaker of the House and 20-term Congress member, announced today that she will not seek re-election next year. She plans to complete her term ending in January of 2027. I had the opportunity to sit down with the former Speaker for Apple News in Conversation in the summer of 2024. We talked about the upheaval in the Democratic Party at the time, with President Biden just having exited the race and Vice President Kamala Harris ramping up her short campaign. But we also spoke about her early years of getting into politics.
Well, when I first went to Congress, there were 23 women out of 435 members. Mm. It was a novelty. It was a rarity to have women in Congress. Then as time went by and our numbers grew, when I was called upon to run for leadership, they said, "Who said she could run?" And I said, "You know what?
Who said that?"
The men, yeah. Mm. "Who said she could run?" And I said, "Why don't you light my fire? I mean, you were really urging me on, if you don't know it."
If you're listening in the Apple News app, we've queued up that episode to play for you next. You can find it in Apple Podcasts by searching for Apple News in Conversation. And I'll be back with the news tomorrow.